A warm welcome to our Thursdays with David Foster Wallace series, where we every week read a section of the infamous Infinite Jest, with the hope, of course, of finishing the book by the end of the year. Today's section is pages 121 to 198 in the 20th Anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text published by Little Brown and Company. I apologize, first off, for having this episode be a day late. I try my best to do things in a timely manner, but sometimes you just are a day behind, and hopefully you guys can be understanding of that, and I am so looking forward to discussing this section with you, and as well reading your comments on the blog afterwards. So let's jump into it. Page 121, we have Mario Incandenza's first and only even remotely romantic experience thus far. So there's this girl at the Enfield Tennis Academy named the USS Militant Kent. She has an interesting backstory. She's a very colorful character, and we hear all of her backstory and as well this very strange incident with Mario in this storybook-like texture of the novel. The USS Militant Kent has this father who's morbidly obese, and he is a cross-dresser, and so even though she's also quite filled in for her age, in terms of her body type, she would find that her and her sister's clothes were really stretched out, and it turns out it's because of this father, and that's part of the reason why she wanted to go to boarding school. And so she just has this very colorful past that we don't get from characters like Pemulis or Schacht quite yet. Anyway, the USS Militant Kent approaches Mario when they are outside on the grounds at ETA, and she says, "Look, there's this telescope that I just found in the middle of the forest," and she sort of gets him alone and starts, for lack of a better term, sexually assaulting Mario. We know at this point a lot about Mario. He's a little bit mentally delayed, he's physically disabled, and there are all sorts of problems in terms of his development and his backstory, and how he's integrated at UTA is very interesting as well. But yeah, she is apparently crazy about him, and she wants to express her feelings in a very physical way in the forest, and it ends in a very awkward encounter with Hal showing up, and they do actually eventually find the tripod with the telescope in the forest at the very end of the encounter. But again, this section stands out as a very narrative storybook-like account, which is interesting in terms of the scope of the entire book, because we don't always get that sort of narrative. Next up on page 126, we have 30th of April, YDAU. This is a common time frame in the book. We already know this. Marathe and Steeply are meeting. And my question here is, why is Steeply never himself? He has appeared to us as a crossdresser. That's his most frequent form. But we learn here in this section that he has been posing as an African American before. He's been in these different forms. And I'm wondering if his sort of deception and his play acting all of the time in his professional life is a notion, an idea of what the company that he works for is also like. So I'm wondering if David Foster Wallace, through Steeply, is giving us a clue about the organization that Steeply works for through Steeply. That is just my thought on that, though. Wonder what you guys think. In 127, page 127, David Foster Wallace restates the entire title, 30th April YDAU, for one line. And I'm just wondering why. Why did he make that formatting decision? That it's so odd. It sticks out like a sore thumb. And he didn't do this when, especially when we were looking at the medical attaché and his wife, and there were one or two lines or maybe a paragraph at the end of the 4th of November sections. He didn't restate the title for those, so why would he do that here for this one sentence? Then on page 128, it's the same timeline here. We have this guy who sits at ETA on the towel dispenser in the gym. I love this quote describing him because the phenomenon is all as incredibly strange. We just have to admit that at a certain point. This guy who sits on the towel rack likes to lick sweat off of people, apparently. So here's the quote on page 128. Quote, "He just smiles, hiding his tongue. He's like a baby. Everything he sees hits him and sinks without bubbles." I love that quote. Maybe the reason why is that it describes the weirdness of the situation a little bit, and it describes his weirdness in a very articulate way. So I don't know if we're ever going to see this guy who sits on the towel dispenser again. I hope we do, because he's a very interesting, again, very colorful character coming out right after our USS Militant Kent section. And yeah, I hope that he shows up again. The next part of this section is there's a new narrative, again, with this African-American vernacular English written out. The sentences are very long. This section is very dense, very complex. It took me forever to read, I'm not gonna lie, because I'm not a fluent speaker and I'm not a native speaker of AAVE. I do my best in terms of trying to look at and analyze what is being said here, but it does take me a long time. It's sort of like reading Old English or a different dialect of English. And we find out that these characters affiliated with Roy Tony live near Enfield, so near ETA. The Enfields, or the characters and the plot lines are getting geographically closer in this whole part of this section. So this whole episode is pretty much about these characters, these narratives, getting geographically closer to one another. And I'm very interested in why David Foster Wallace is doing this and how this is going to turn out. And in this section, I can't delve into it a lot because this channel is PG, but it's about the adventures of three prostitutes, and one of them, named C, dies when C has a drug overdose from drugs that were laced with products that were harmful, that were not meant to be consumed. And I'll just leave it at that. Our next section is 3rd of November, YDAU, on page 135. This is a phone call between Oren and Hal in Condensa. This is a really interesting section too, because here we have a continuation of this weird relationship between Oren and Hal on the phone, because up until this point in the novel, most of their communication, if not all of it, has been over the phone through memories. We had one memory at the very beginning of the book with Hal and Oren. But really, in this phone conversation, they're having two different conversations at once. One is where Hal is talking about himself and his fears and his problems at the moment, and the other is where Oren is discussing, or rather describing, a person in Tucson, I think, where he's living, who has fallen on the sidewalk and has sizzled because it's so hot outside, and he's just laying there, and people are bypassing him on the sidewalk, and Oren is just watching this man essentially lay on the sidewalk. So there are just two very different things going on in this conversation, and we don't get much closure in terms of where Oren and Hal are at the end. The next part of this section is a description of Ennett House, which we learn later is in Enfield as well. And it was founded by this guy who was so into Alcoholics Anonymous that he took the no last name thing to the extreme, and no one knows his name to this day. He just sort of calls it Ennett House. It has no relation to his name whatsoever. There are a lot of weird quirks with this guy. I'm not going to get into exactly the initiation ceremonies of getting to live in Ennett House or anything like that, but it's just, it's an odd startup to this building, this company that becomes very important to the book. So I think it's important to remember that this Ennett House place comes from this crazy guy from AA who has no name. The next part is on page 138, the Year of the Dairy Products from the American Heartland, and this is where the titles of the sections start getting very long and very complex, so I'm just going to shorten them like I did this title. You guys can look at the full titles in your own books on your own time. But here are just emails, and This email is one of the funniest sections that I've ever read in the book. It really connected with me a lot. And I think these are litigation emails of some sort. And there's this bricklayer, essentially. We're just thrusted into a new narrative here completely, as always with David Foster Wallace. There's this bricklayer, and he has a lot of health concerns, a lot of things going on, and we learn that he was at the top of this building laying bricks, and he didn't want to carry the bricks all the way down to the ground, so what he did is he put 900 kilograms of bricks on a pulley system and went down to the ground and released the bricks, and he weighs only 75 kilograms. So you can imagine what happened when the bricks started going down on this pulley. He started going up, and a lot of crazy things happened to him. He obviously got very injured, and yeah, this was just such a weird, irreverent story, in my opinion, but very funny. The next section is on page 140. This is Hal's first extant written comment. And this is in the year of the Purdue Wonder Chicken. So this is 1 year after Dr. Incandenza, Hal's father, dies. We already discussed this in the last episode a little bit, but the year that Dr. Incandenza dies, or this period, is becoming sort of a pivot for all of the other years in the book. So we can know when each narrative is taking place based on its relationship temporally to when Dr. Incandenza commits suicide. So this is 1 year after that. Hal is in the seventh grade here. He's writing his seventh grade paper. I love this section just because I'm a grammar nerd, and I love how David Foster Wallace deliberately puts in written mistakes and things that make it seemed like a seventh grade paper. I mean, Hal is very advanced, we already know this, and so the paper is very advanced, but it does go on tangents, and it is a little bit overly vociferous at times, and it does give you the feeling that you are reading something maybe from someone who isn't as mature with their writing yet. So I like that he was able to adapt his writing style to this particular scene of Hal. The next section is Steepley's profile on Orrin Incandenza, which is interesting because this profile doesn't really become about Orrin Incandenza at all. This takes place in the YDAU, which is 4 years after Dr. Incandenza dies. Again, this pivot point of the suicide. Apparently, we know from this section that Dr. Incandenza puts his head in a microwave oven. So the article eventually transitions into being about a woman with an external artificial heart. So an artificial heart that she carries in her purse. And she gets robbed by characters from the 30th of April YDAU section from page 126. And we know this because the robber has a feather boa, and the entire time the narrator is talking about their friend who also has a feather boa. So these profiles are connected. We see that there is a definite geographical connection here. And then I just wanted to point out on page 144 in this section, there's a list. David Foster Wallace just gives it all to you. It's a list of anti-Onan groups. So if you're interested in the politics of this made-up world that David Foster Wallace is imagining, that is a good place to start with the list of anti-Onan groups. The Wheelchair Assassins is on there, and I think Steepley's Association is on there. All of those kinds of things. Page 144 to 145. Here we have another section. It's a super long title, but essentially what the title is getting at, it's a two-page long title here, and it's why consumers resort to plain telephones rather than to video telephones. So why they like plain talking on the phone without being able to see each other versus something like FaceTime, for example. So this, to me, is a matter-of-fact social criteria, social commentary that David Foster Wallace is throwing out into the world. I think his opinions and his observations are very astute here. And one of his points here is that you can be distracted while talking on the phone, yet not suspect the other person who's talking on the phone with you to be distracted as well, which is totally true. I never thought about this before, but it's exactly true. Then he goes through this sort of snowball situation in which people get more and more into the FaceTiming situation, and they start making masks for themselves, and they just put on the mask, so it seems like they're paying attention during the FaceTime call, and it escalates all the way until these big body suits that people will just wear because the technology evolves enough where you look at your whole body when you're FaceTiming. And yeah, it's just a very odd scenario. It's very sci-fi, and a great contrast to the sections that we've seen before. Our next section is October YDAU. They are drug testing the kids at ETA, even though we learn in this section that Pemulus, one of the tennis players and Hal and Mario's friend, Pemulus sells both drugs and clean urine. So what he does is he goes to the junior division, and he just collects clean urine from them and sells it. I do want to say in page 153 here, there's a description of the Onin logo that I do want to read really quick. A snarling full front eagle with a broom and can of disinfectant in one claw and a maple leaf in the other, and wearing a sombrero and appearing to have about half eaten a swatch of star-studded cloth. So that is the Onin logo, and Onin is the North American coalition, so we have Canada and Mexico included in that. Very interesting. It's sort of like, it sort of gives me the same feelings as the adult diaper with the Statue of Liberty image that he gives us in the beginning. It's just, I don't know how I feel about it at this point, how he has crafted this country, and it's just so imaginative and it's so unique. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about this country and the things that are going on in it. So back to Pemulus. Pemulus is a very paranoid person. We know this off the bat, and it's stated explicitly in the text as well. But he's on Dr. Incandenza's scholarship. There's only one scholarship, and the reason why he's on it is because he has a brain for the hard sciences. So we see these many sides of him, and that's what I love about this book too, is that it takes the time to delve into the multifaceted nature of a lot of the characters. And so we see this hard sciences side of him, but we also see this drug dealing side, this paranoid side. And I also want to just bring some light and attention on footnote 55, which is in this section, and it's a commentary of what Hal has to say about the narrative and about the situation, and I've never thought about this before. It's very fourth wall. It breaks the fourth wall quite clearly, because Hal is directly commenting on what he thinks about the narrative. He substitutes words and things like that. So I love that footnote 55, and if you want to take a look at that, it's a great section to turn to. Our next section is Winter BS 1960, Tucson, Arizona. It's so weird for me still seeing Tucson, Arizona everywhere. I grew up in Tucson, so I just never thought that Tucson would make it into amazing literature like this, and it's still strange just to see it written on that page. But here we are in Tucson in 1960. The narrator here is Dr. Incandenza's father, James Incandenza's father. His father is an alcoholic. It's very clear from this section. The father goes through all of these monologues, and most of them are spoken out loud. So he goes through this Marlon Brando monologue and how Marlon Brando as a figure is teaching people to be discourteous to the people and objects around them. Then he starts talking about how your body is important and you have to learn how to live in your body and learn how to be very in touch with this physical space and physical side of yourself. And then he starts talking about tennis and how he got into tennis. But what I really gained from this section, besides just the oddity of Jim or James Incandenza's childhood, which tells a lot about him probably, is that he's 10 years old and he's 5'11". What? I'm 5'4", fully grown. You know, I'm a grown person. And he's 10 years old and 5'11", and he's already also reading books about crazy physics. So we get a sense here also about how special James Incandenza was as a person. And I think that was a really valuable glimpse into his childhood and into his psyche, even though the narrator is again his father. The next section is very brief. It's 4th November, YDAU. This is Pemulus. He's going to his storage truck where he stores urine and drugs, essentially. And he is communicating with Hal about buying drugs. There's this quip that when you call Pemulus to buy drugs, you must ask him to commit a crime. So you have to say, "Hey Pemulus, I want you to commit a crime. I'm threatening you," essentially. And Pemulus will say, "Oh golly me. You know, I don't want to commit a crime," but it's just because he's paranoid, essentially. He's created this code because he's so paranoid that he's going to get caught that he's put these institutional-like structures into the way he does business. It's very interesting. So on page 172, we have Tennis and the Feral Prodigy. This is a film that was made in April of the year of the Ushetsu, which is 3 years after Dr. Incandenza dies. So this is 1 year before the YDAU. And yeah, it's Hal and Mario's film. They get an honorable mention for the film. I love this film script. This is one of my favorite sections in the book so far. I know I might keep alluding to my favorite sections, but this one really touched me. It's the film itself is much about making the rhythm of the academy, and by extension, the rhythm and the feeling of their father into art. And I think that there's something really beautiful in the way that they articulated that. That's my opinion anyway. Next section, page 176, transcripts of the CSAC, Patricia Montesian, and this is in the 4th of November YDAU timeframe. So Patricia is Pat is a psychologist at the Ennett House. This reminds me a lot of his book Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. I have to recheck on the time frame of this book that when he wrote Brief Interviews, but it just reminds me so much of the little sections. And Brief Interviews is a bunch of short stories. They're basically confessionals, things like that. And they're all fictional of people that have been imprisoned or have done terrible things. So these really remind me, just in micro form, of that book. In page 179 and 180, we learn more about this weird drug dealer who lives in the trailer who owns a snake. I know that he's important to the novel, but why does he keep coming up in the most unexpected places? And we learn that he has this speech impediment, or speech idiolect, rather, is what I want to say, where he says so, like tho. So it's almost a lisp, but it's not really described by lisp because the character who's describing it is saying that he has physical features that impede certain sounds that he makes. And we learn that this character is the same character from earlier who marries Mildred, his middle school or high school sweetheart, and has Harriet, the baby, and they ended up being roommates. And this guy is at Ennett House. So again, Ennett House, we're getting geographically closer to ETA. And all the narratives are starting to combine a little bit. So the last section here goes from 181 to 198, which is our ending section for today, late October YDAU. We're listening to MIT's WYYY program on the radio. You can basically on this program read anything, but it must be in a cartoon voice. So we start out with this. What I ended up making notes on in my journal here is that the character who starts off this section has a very distinct idiolect where they pronounce R's as W's, so like wabbit instead of rabbit. And I realized later that it wasn't a character with an idiolect, it was just someone imitating a cartoon character, which I found hilarious. But this program precedes this very popular program, which is going to be very vital to the book, I think, that's my prediction, called Madame Psychosis. It's mysterious, but it's so wildly popular, and that's what's interesting to me. I have a quote here from page 185. Quote, "The monologues seem both free associative and intricately structured, not unlike nightmares." So there's this discussion of ETA curriculum right after that. This section is woven like a tapestry, okay? It goes between ETA, Avril and Cadenza, and Hal and Mario, their little section, to the radio engineer at the station and Madame Psychosis. It's very cool, this section. So there's this discussion of ETA curriculum, and there's also a discussion of Avril and her green thumb. She's really into plants, and we learn that she has Hal and Mario over late twice a week just so that she can be with her kids outside of the industrial monotony of ETA. Really sweet. And we learn about Mario's love for Madame Psychosis, the radio show, which he listens to on these twice-weekly visits. On page 192 and 193, if you guys want to take a look at that section, this is a really cool weaving of the Avril dinner and the radio tech and Madame Psychosis together. I love the way that this section transitions in and out in pages 192 to 193. So if you're looking for a good example of weaving, that's a great one. And the last part of this section is a new narrative. We have the Ennett House setup. So this is more of an omniscient narrator sort of scenario. And it describes in detail units number 1 through number 7 of the Ennett House. They're really bordering the Ennett House, and essentially all of the units have a different sort of halfway vibe. So one of them is for Alzheimer's patients. Ennett House, as we know, is for recovering drug dealers and drug addicts. Some of the houses are more in shape than others. There's one of the houses, I think number 2, that's being renovated currently, and they're excited to see what sort of group that will pertain to. And there's house number 7, which is deserted, and it's right next to this big hill. And we learn at the end of the section that ETA still pays for the rent, the mortgage, on this house number 7, and that the hill was made because Enfield Tennis Academy was built on a mountain that was leveled so that they could make tennis courts. And the craziest thing is that at the very end of the section, we geographically slam together. So ETA, the highest peak that has been mentioned in the ETA sections, is the peak next to house number 7, which is right next to Ennett House. So Ennett House is literally right next to ETA, the tennis academy. So here we end with also this reintroduction of Don Gately, who I believe is the person that we know who killed the Quebec guy who had the cold, and Don Gately is a narcotics addict. And I'm wondering, as sort of a last question for this section, is there a connection between Mario and his disabilities that are discussed in terms of his relationship with people staffed at Ennett House, and Ennett House itself and the people there, and Madame Psychosis? Because during this section, Madame Psychosis is reading from basically a disabilities handbook, and she has this stream of consciousness, but deliberate stream of consciousness, if that's a thing, monologue about the disabled. So I'm wondering if all of those three threads connect somehow, and I'm wondering how and when those will connect. Thank you guys so much for listening. We have an episode on this new book that I just got in the mail last week. It just came out last week. It's called I Know You Know Who I Am by Peter Kispert. I have been blazing through this book, you guys. I cannot wait to discuss it on Monday. So I will see you guys on Monday the 24th in avid anticipation of this Kispert book. See you then. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there's a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.